and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. Episode 21 is what we're on now. Joined by David Ishida.
Yes, I have returned. Slash, return of the king, the second billing.
Slash Ben Robertson, one person.
Hey, the podcast is now can now legally drink.
Hi. That's a good point.
It is a good point.
Where's the celebratory scotch?
David just runs off.
No, it's still morning. So, great episode today.
Somewhere.
I have been waiting to talk about this for a long time. We're going to start off with After Effects and then Tricks of the Trade, move into some specific compositing tricks, which we'll get into later. I want to save for a surprise. And then finally, we saw Infinity Wars. Da 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 da. Which,
wait, that's the wrong thing.
If you're like me, you've probably seen a dozen online reviews of the of that movie already. But why not? Let's hear our thoughts because we have many. So so starting right off,
obviously you people care.
Yes, so much.
And by you people, I mean the listeners.
What do you mean, you people? nerds. So anyway, After Effects. I've been wanting to talk about this for a long time. Obviously, for compositing software, the industry standard is more towards Nuke. But we, being the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast, the more indie and affordable choice is After Effects. So we're going to cover that.
Yeah,
and also, none of us are experts in Nuke. So we're just going to cover what we know.
Yep.
So obviously, After Effects is part of the Adobe CC suite. And I think it's probably necessary to get a bundle of software if you're using After Effects, not just After Effects, right?
Yeah.
Because it seems more of like a complementary tool,
yeah,
right?
I mean, I use it personally in conjunction with Premiere and Photoshop at least, so.
Yep.
And Adobe, in their wise ways, made it subscription-based now, so you have to get, what is it like, if you want more than one, you have to pay for all of them monthly?
So you can pay for them all individually if you really want to.
Oh, you
but
can.
Really, yeah, so you can. I want to do this app, or I want to pay for this app specifically, and then I want to pay for this app specifically.
But like, as soon as you get like two or more, then
it doesn't make sense.
Then it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. They kind of encourage you to get the whole suite.
Which is $50 a month for all of them?
If you're not going to get find any sort of like discount anywhere.
Yeah.
I believe
there are student discounts if you're still students, so you can get it in for like 30 or you said
30. Yeah.
So gotcha. There are cheaper ways to get into it.
And sometimes they have like promotions where they'll do it for cheaper too. Mm.
So compositing, what is it and why do you need it? It's a visual effect term that means you are taking an element and you are putting it on top of or somewhere inside of another element, be it some sort of background in your live action or
foreground element or midground element it's anywhere.
A good example is when Freddie W and Corridor Digital got big back in 2010 on YouTube, they did a lot of compositing with gun flares, like muzzle flares, basic things like that.
Lightsaber effects.
Yep, exactly. Lightsabers was one of the first things being composited on YouTube, I want to say.
And also, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is specifically dealing with when you are putting in usually CGI elements or secondary elements into live action things. So if you're doing a scene that's completely CG with no real elements, is it still compositing?
I think it can be, yeah. So for example, like in like a Blizzard cinematic, they'll add like certain effects in compositing that they don't do in their 3D editor.
Okay, yep. I didn't know if it was different when it was all CG versus into live action.
I mean, I think most people use it for that, but there are examples of pure CG.
Yeah.
But it's really powerful software and kind of hard to learn at first if you're not really sure where to start because it can do so much. So basically how we've learned to use it is obviously like all things we talk about on this podcast, Down Under Heaven. Basically, we started working on our Prelude teaser back in 2012. And for that, I started learning how to do camera tracking and then solving for like the background. Basically, if the camera's moving and you want something in the background, you know, make it look somewhat convincing by matching the camera's movement. And things like muzzle flares and
keying and chroma keying.
Yeah, yeah. Actually,
Luma keying.
I want to say, because the thing we did just before that was our finger bang short, which would have properly been done in After Effects, but I think the little bit that I did was in Final Cut Pro.
I think everyone
7.
Used it. I think because I think it was you, Ben, and Lee Yeah. We're all doing the VFX, and I think all three of you use different software to do it, including a fantastic shot. And it's a shame it's not on YouTube anymore, but a fantastic shot that Ben put a gun flare in, and it goes on, it goes outside.
No, that wasn't me. That was me.
Oh, it was you. You put a gun flare that went outside of the letterboxing.
3D. Yeah, I got the layers wrong. Just because, that was back before I think Final Cut 10 came out. So I used 7. And man, those are rough days trying to composite in Final Cut 7 before taking the plunge. So anyway, I remember one of the key shots we had to do was a plasma grenade hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Ben, you gave me the idea to use a blood splatter
as the color.
Yeah, as the element. So basically,
that's a good idea.
Making it look like a splattering plasma liquid.
Yeah.
And so that worked out pretty well, I think. And then, God, there's a lot of stuff in that teaser. There's rotoscoping, which I think is one of the earliest things I learned how to do in After Effects. By the way,
I
should give an honorable mention here to Shake, which is Apple's compositor software, which I don't think you knew about. I did not know about.
We were watching. We had a work day, and we were watching the behind the scenes on the Two Towers, and you caught on one of their screens that was Shake. I had no idea that Apple made an After Effects competitor worthy
this
software.
This is news to me.
So it's a node-based compositor that they discontinued in 2006. Lee actually used it quite a bit and was sad about its cancellation. I actually tried it in, I think, 2005 when I tried to do a lightsaber little mini commercial. But yeah, it was a really powerful piece of software. I think I just got the trial. But yeah, Apple decided to get out of the VFX game and focus on just NLE editing. But honorable mention aside, so obviously for most people, After Effects is the main compositor they're going to use. It is a track-based compositor as opposed to node-based. So basically, like in any editor, you just have your tracks in layers and in different parts from bottom to top, and top is on top and bottom's on bottom, obviously, as opposed to node-based, which is where you have your different, I don't know. It's like a tree.
It's like a web chart.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like a flow chart.
Mm-hmm. And the other one that other people may be familiar with that is node based is Resolve, DaVinci Resolve, or it has a node based thing you can look at, and also in Blender, Blender has a node based setup to look at.
Right.
If you want to look that way rather than going through the panes.
Is it easier to go from one to the other? Because I feel like it kind of makes sense to do the whole track based when you're in the Adobe world, because everything is already kind of based on layers anyway.
Absolutely. I think it's kind of changing how your brain works a little bit, because I'm still sort of trying to get into the node-based workflows. For someone like Lee, who's done it for a long time, it makes a lot of sense. But for me, I can see how it's intuitive, right? Because you have your different effects and your different elements and sources and generators all feeding into different things, and you can just follow like what they're connected to and in what order they're connected, and it just makes sense from that perspective. But it's like, it is different, whereas if you're used to working with a track-based system, it's probably going to take you a little bit of time to learn the workflow.
I've noticed, because I've been in the process, the slow and arduous process of learning texturing in Blender, and The textures I'm using, like, it all is utilized through node-based stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I really like node-based. I understand the principle of how node-based works. I know that the big challenge for me is figuring out, is learning, like, what they're calling things and what different inputs and outputs do.
Yeah.
And how they need to run into each other. That's where it's needing to learn all these new terminologies about what
I think
they're talking about.
When you do get into that 3D software, which we very loosely covered in our Armageddon episode, like in Maya.
Oh, that movie.
In Maya, the hyper shader, which is the same place where you can fine tune your textures and stuff, that is also node based. And so I think it really wouldn't work in a track based system for that sort of thing. But in After Effects, I think it's sort of a neat little middle ground between that and between the 3D software and an NLE. So it's like, if you're used to Premiere, then it just makes it easier to just right click, send a Adobe dynamic link, which I don't recommend because
it breaks things.
Well, no one uses that, because what it does, if you're in Premiere and you right click on a shot and you say send After Effects for Adobe dynamic link composition, whatever, it replaces your footage with a composition that's like an After Effects sequence, which if you save that, you've gone to After Effects and you do stuff and you save it, it copies back over to Premiere. But the problem is now your footage cannot be reverted back to footage. It's a composition.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Your in-out points are baked in and it's basically locked in. So what people do is they you know, send it over, but then they undo in Premiere. So it's you still got your footage. But anyway, so it can do a lot of powerful things. And one of the best ways to learn is you could go and like watch a YouTube tutorial. But what I found is, you know, if you start with a shot and you say, what do I want to do in this shot? Like, do I want to replace the background? Do I want to put in like put something on that tree and just kind of make it look like it's there when I move the camera, you know, a specific thing. And then, you know, look up how to do that. So
yeah,
that was my
way. And it also would probably be the best thing to do is if you're going to do something like that, get the either you know, if you can find footage that you want to use, cool. Otherwise, if you're going to capture your own, I'd say do a completely static camera.
Mm-hmm.
Don't move it at all. Don't necessarily jump in by wanting to do complete camera solves, which can be an arduous.
No, it's arduous.
It can be a difficult process.
right.
To do. If you look at so many of the major YouTubers that do a lot of VFX work, look at Corridor Digital, look at Rocket Jump back in the day, look at Film Riot. They're all using After Effects as their primary compositing software, and all of them have some really, really great tutorials and explanations, especially Film Riot.
And
they
especially
do a really good job of explaining how they do all these different things.
Yeah, and especially on muzzle flares, because they've, like, Freddie W and Quarter Digital at this point have done so many muzzle flares, they're like the professionals at it.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
So is After Effects like great out of the box, or are there like other add-ons or
plugins that you want to get? That's a great point. There are a lot of plugins. I don't use particularly a whole lot, except for two, and it's from Video Copilot, which thank you for reminding me about plugins. So Video Copilot is this fantastic site hosted by Andrew Kramer, who develops all these great plugins, which the bread and butter of for me is Element 3D, which is a great way to... I mean, it's not just a great way. It's the way to import 3D models into After Effects and customize them to a staggering degree, but also do some pretty incredible 3D text. Mm-hmm. I know for like Final Cut, they made you able to do 3D text, but this is incredibly detailed and really good looking 3D text that has like built in shaders that you can just drag and drop in a really intuitive interface.
And
so
didn't Video Copilot, aren't they also the ones, aren't they Action Essentials?
Yes.
The ones who made that.
Yep.
Maybe that's one thing. I think that's what we used for that plasma effect, and that that we have. We have Action Essentials 2K, which is a whole slew of pre-made composition elements, and so they're created in what we call alpha channel. So they're designed in a way that, like, there's a bunch of gun flares, for example, and they're shot in a way that only the gun flare is there, like the background, if you will, is transparent.
Yep.
So you can plop it in anywhere. You don't need to re-roto it or re-chroma it.
Yeah.
But they have things like gun flares. They have explosions. They have like bullet hits on walls
dust
and
particles.
Dust particles, like all the stuff that smoke. A lot of really cool smoke things.
Which makes sense. Like it's kind of in hindsight, like, oh, of course. But when it came out, it was like kind of a revolution.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And you do have to be careful with it though, because there are some effects in there that are used a lot.
Yes.
And so it can look, you know, like it did, like for us, you know, what, 10 years ago or 12 years ago when we were in high school, and like you can like at this point, if you see someone using Windows Movie Maker, you know immediately.
Yeah.
You know, so like there are some things where it's like it stands out that it is a pre-made thing from Action Essentials because it has been so commonly used.
Like a blood splatter or whatever.
Right.
At this point, you can
like
definitely
some of the
tell.
Smoke, like you can tell like, oh, that's a smoke variety from Action Essentials. You can tell.
So, but some of the other plugins, so Element 3D, obviously a great thing to have just as like introducing 3D elements into your compositions, but also optical flares is a godsend. I mean, After Effects has I think three built-in lens flares, but they're all very simplistic and kind of lame looking, especially compared to what Action Essentials or Video Copilot has. So the optical flare plugin from Video Copilot has a, especially if you get the add-ons, which I think is another $50 or so, you get like 100 presets, and they're all badass Michael Bay looking lens flares.
Nice.
So that I think you can get. They offer a bunch of bundles. So Element 3D with like a motion design pack, which has some like preset, you know, fun little arrows and just like things that come in handy with optical flares. You could probably get a bundle for I want to say $300. They had an NAB sale, which might be still be going on. Which you just type in NAB 2018 when you check out, and you get like I want to say 25% off, some ridiculous number. Yeah. But yeah, they Video Copilot, if you're using After Effects, is just the best. I mean, obviously you can get, there's other plugins too, like Red Giant and a couple
Hitfilm,
others.
I think they do some plugins too, I think.
Yeah, Hitfilm, isn't that their own editor slash
they compositor? Do have one, but I think they make other sure. plugin elements as well.
Yeah. But I would far and away recommend Video Copilot as the go-to place for your plugins for After Effects, especially if you want to introduce some 3D elements as well. If, mm-hmm. if you don't want to quite tackle Maya or Blender yet, it's a good way to kind of get introduced to 3D elements and how they work and operate within a compositor. Yeah. So,
and if you're gonna start trying it out for the first time, start small. Do things as simple as adding something into it, like adding a, you know, add a monolith into the scene, into a scene.
A monolith being a reference to 2001 yes, Space Odyssey,
yes.
which is a big black rectangle.
Yes. You start simple, or, you know, you could even do like try doing a sky replacement. If you're going to try that for the first time, I'd say avoid trees. Mm-hmm. Just to start out, is that?
But you can get around that, and I found some really good tutorials.
With LumaKey, I think is what you're.
Yeah, but even so, really quick touching on this. So LumaKey is a way to key out brightness or darkness. You can do it on a bright sunny day or just a bright cloudy day like we have today to key out the white of the sky. But sometimes with trees, you'll run into trouble areas where, you know, the detail is so intricate you can't quite get it. So there are great tutorials on how to even get further detail pulled out without beyond just what a LumaKey can do. But sorry for droning on and on about After Effects. In Tricks of the Trade, we're going to cover some more advanced After Effects techniques.
3D techniques.
Yeah, that we're also going to be showing you in our introductory video of Indie Film Toolkit on YouTube. So we'll be right back.
Making promises now, I see.
Yeah, so by now, by the time this episode airs, there will be a video on YouTube that you can go check out right now about this technique.
Coming. Winter 2018. Trademark.
Soon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, anyone who knows me knows that that's a recurring thing. So specifically, I want to talk about camera tracking and creating virtual cameras. So back when
The joy.
Yeah,
the joys of the hours we have spent losing hair.
Well, yeah.
Looking at all our mistakes from filming.
So, quick background for this. When I was a junior in high school, my friend Paul was telling me about, it might have been Lee, it was one of those guys, was telling me about software that you could put in video you had shot, and the software could determine how the camera's moving within the actual space you shot in. And that concept blew my mind. Mm-hmm. I thought, how could software take pixels on a computer,
flat pixels,
and show you how the camera's moving within 3D space.
And to be clear, this is different from motion tracking. This is a different aspect,
right? Which is similar, but
not nearly as complicated. Motion tracking being if you have a moving shot, like if you've seen text in the BBC Sherlock TV series, you see text messages pop up on screen, and it's like it is stuck to a phone. Like when the phone moves, it's moving. That mm-hmm. is motion tracking. So that's tracking an element in the shot, whereas this is solving for the camera's movement and making a virtual camera. Just so we're clear on what's the difference.
Exactly. So basically, there's a lot of great tutorials about this. The one chiefly among them I'd recommend is from Quarter Digital, where they recommend starting off by taking a camera out in a parking lot or some open space and just panning left and right. Or tilting and not moving the camera around.
Z-space.
Yeah, not quite yet. While you can do that, it's easier just to start with a simple pan or tilt.
Basically, a one-dimensional move.
Yeah, because the problem there is the parallax that you get if you move it too much.
Oh, yes, we know all about parallax.
So the issue here is that you want the shot to sell. You want it to look convincing, and if you do things to complicate the shot, like adding parallax, it makes it much harder to sell the shot. So what you do is then you bring the shot into After Effects and use the motion tracking
tool set.
Yeah, you go to Windows and then Workspaces, and there's like a motion tracking workspace, and then in the right hand side there's an option to
camera solve.
Yeah, and basically what you're able to do then is throw an element like a background element at the footage, and you know, if it's a 3D object, all 3D objects follow a camera you make, and then it just behaves as if it's in the shot.
Yep.
It's almost like magic.
Mm-hmm. And actually, fun tidbit for that, the movie that really made leaps and bounds improvements to this technology was the very well-received District 9, directed by Neil Blomkamp.
Actually, which should have been the Halo movie.
Yes, it should have. but that movie, actually, I think they won several scientific awards for their improvements that were made to tracking software and technologies on the back end. And like, you know, as Wade was saying, you can do this natively in After Effects. You can also do this natively in Blender. Like, that's what we use when we're trying to, when we need to do a camera solve and using 3D spaces, is we've been doing that in Blender because mm-hmm. it makes life a lot easier.
Yeah.
But there are standalone programs as well that do this very, very well, and they're very, very powerful. A really, really powerful one is very expensive, I believe. I think it's like $2,000 or $3,000, I think. It's called Buju.
And that is just camera tracking, right?
Yes, or camera solving. Camera solving and motion solving. That's it. It doesn't do anything else. It is incredibly powerful. It is incredibly precise.
Yeah.
When you learn it and figure out how to use it. I've messed around with it in the past. Quarter Digital, they have a really great tutorial about it. As I said, it's a great tutorial, but it is difficult as it is. There is a large mm-hmm. barrier of entry,
yeah,
because of how expensive it is.
And the reason why you'd use this is because some of the tracking tools in like Blender and After Effects isn't quite as robust as you'd want for some shots.
Yeah, it's like the whole mindset of what Final Cut Studio 3 used to be and what the Adobe suite is now. The idea being you have like standalone programs that get to do their one job
yeah.
incredibly well, rather than trying to make one program do everything okay.
Yeah, yeah. But they still kind of do that though with Photoshop, because you yeah. can edit movies in Photoshop.
You can?
Yes.
Oh, my
oh,
God.
Why?
Wow. You just blew my mind,
son. I mean, I think I remember when they introduced video clips being able to use, but like, why? I mean, I'm sure there's a reason, but
why? I'm not sure if it carries audio, but I know for a fact that you can like,
Is that someone like at a festival, like the first film edited in Photoshop?
We shot this on the backup like, camera of a
yeah,
Prius.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah, it's like, why would you?
Oh, God.
I could just imagine like lens adapters being put on like a backup camera. Oh no.
I've done a bunch of camera solves for 3D moves, and you do have to be careful, as Wade was talking about, with if you're starting to introduce Z movement. So if the camera is handheld and it's moving considerably, as you do need to be able to track elements in the scene that are moving, sort of moving, not actually moving, but from the camera's perspective, moving in the Z space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you don't know what that is you have your X axis, which goes left to right, your Y axis that goes up and down, and then Z axis is that third, like the 3D yep. space.
So if you wanted to do a dolly push in shot, mm-hmm. you know, you say like we had a shot where it was a crane shot, so a multi-axis crane move, and the actors were up against a green screen, and then what we did is we put C stands in the shot mm-hmm. with green tape on the ends that would again be moving correctly in the Z space, so the software had something to track to in Z space.
Yeah, and if you ask Lee, he'll say we needed like
40 more of them.
40 more track points, which is probably true. Yeah,
the more the merrier.
Yes.
And you know, if you're and you should be, if you're practicing this or working on it, you should keep in mind that, you know, you're compositing things in, so you can cheat things as far as track points, because they may be covered up or disappear.
Yes.
So say, like as my earlier joke, you want to put a monolith in your scene. You could put a big green sandbag or whatever in the middle of the street to track to, because your monolith will be covering it up.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter that that's there, and you need a strong tracking point.
Or even if it's not covering it up, you could do what Weta commonly does, and then get a plate. And yep. they use that, basically a plate is an element or a shot.
A clean shot.
Without the sandbag or whatever stand in it. So you have that background to reintroduce into your composition to make up. So you can basically erase the sandbag or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. And there are other tricks you can do. I know we did a 48-hour film fest short many years ago now called The Gardener. And there was a shot where you saw the boom in the top. And luckily it was... there were basically the background of where it was trees, was the dappling of trees. And so Lee was basically able to take another chunk from another part of that same shot.
I never knew about that.
And slide it over and cover it up. And you basically mess with the opacity. And because it's all the dappling of trees, you sort of just sort of fudged it. And you didn't make a square to replace it. You sort of made a dappled leap thing. So the it sort of blurred. It wasn't a big cover up. It would be hard pressed to notice it.
You can tell but that David works in camera department. He uses the term dapple.
Dappling. Well, yeah. Of course, you get real fancy. You can get to I forgot the real name. So like there's the fake dappling of trees that you use. It's a big wooden cutout.
Branchosaurus?
No. there's branchalores, which are when you use an actual tree branch to cover, you put it on a stand to give you the light pattern, but there's also the actual thing, which is basically a flat 2D wooden cut up pattern, and it's also called something lures.
I could see that being used a lot in stage performances, or no? Is it not?
Yes, it's used in stage, but you remember, like, we used it basically in almost every day shot in the movie we worked on.
Yeah.
3-day weekend had that because it breaks up things. It's helpful if you need to cover up the shadows of stands or of drops or silks or something, like big 8x things. You put those on some of the edges, and so if you're shading somebody and you see the shadow of it in the shot, you can break it up, break away from that hard edge with these tree branches, and then the audience sort of forgets about it.
Fascinating. We'll have to actually cover some of that in a different episode.
Yes, we should.
I think that'd be great.
That's a good point.
But finally, getting to the last part of our tricks of the trade is the technique that we will be using in this. In this episode of Indie Film Toolkit on YouTube is creating a virtual camera in a shot that does not move. So, David, you had alluded to in the last segment about locking off a camera, making it static, and then that way making it easier to move things around without having a camera track or solve for the camera. So, for the previs for this shot, I basically animated a Pelican spaceship flying in, and then stuck it to a wide, photo element, basically just a shot of a landscape. And because they both were such high resolution, I then created a virtual camera in After Effects and then made all the camera movement within After Effects. So basically, you can control, I think, pretty much every element of an actual camera. You can control the placement, the zoom, the point of interest. You can control the aperture, the depth of field. You can control all these aspects. And you can choose like what lens is on it or what focal length, and basically what you're able to do is like quick zooms and kind of shaky cam and all these great things to add life to your shot if you just shoot it static, which is the idea here. Because what we're going to be doing is not only rotoscoping trees, which is meticulous in and of itself,
yes it is,
but adding a spaceship flying in, adding smoke, and all these things that would have to do meticulous, tedious motion tracking.
Arduous
motion tracking. We can simplify by shooting static in a wide angle and then punching in from 4K because we're delivering in 2K. So it worked pretty well in the previs, and I think it can, and I know it can work well in the live
it
action.
It kind of reminded me of shots that were done in Battlestar Galactica. And I think a little bit in Firefly too, where like you have spaceships that are flying in space or whatever, and like you have the whole like zoom in or they're moving around. I'm sure they're probably using the same technique that you are.
And while we could just go out to our landscape and shoot, the cam shaky and kind of do that in camera, that would create so much work in post to try and track the ship to actually look like it's flying through the shot and not jumping around like crazy. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we realized very quickly in like the Prelude trailer, for example, is that when you do move the camera around and you have ships flying in the distance, especially if it's just clouds to track to, it's really hard to track that motion. So we actually later shots of the Prelude, when we went back, we actually just made it locked off because we knew we wanted to add a little bit of movement in post, and it worked much more easily. And so that's what I would recommend starting out.
With a $1 million budget and an army of people behind you, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. And honestly, a lot of the people who do post for films like Infinity Wars, which we're going to be talking about, have to basically do a little catch up and play doctor and fix some of the shots because the camera and the production team, we're in the moment, we're just trying to get a really effective performance, and so maybe there are some things that they screwed up from a visual effects perspective, and then the VFX team has to go in and okay, now we have to create a new camera and fix this thing that's moving that shouldn't be, and you know, rotoscope that out.
Well, now it's common to even have visual effects representatives or like
VFX supervisors on
set. Because there was a feature I worked on up in Duluth 2 weeks ago that had one on set all the time.
Yeah, and that's vital, which we didn't have for most of Dawn, which would have helped out. So, for example, one of the things we did in Dawn was the main character has a hologram on his gauntlet, and so to track the hologram, we put these just gratuitously large green
stickers.
They're
like the for sale green dots that you put on garage sale things.
So we put four, one on each corner of the hologram pad. Of course, now we know that that's next to useless, because it's worse than useless, because not only do we have to remove those, we could have just tracked to the gauntlet, because it's not like he was on black.
Or we could have made those dots like a tenth the size.
Yeah. Or just done one. It's something that we thought was a good idea at the time. Mm-hmm. And then we realized, oh crap, we have to actually make this look good in post.
Yep. So if you are looking at doing this kind of VFX work, I'd say make sure you do your research on knowing what effects you want to do for a shot. And if it's not going to be you doing it and you have a friend or you're hiring someone to do it, make sure you talk with them so that they can give their advice from what would make it the easiest and simplest on their end in post to make. So, you know, you're not going to spend hours having to solve for motions that are cut off by the edge of frame.
Or
like having to deal with, oh, wait, now there's going to be, you know, odd reflections that now need to be removed or dialed out somehow.
Yeah, there's a lot more we could go into with After Effects, and I'd love to at a later date. But for now, that's the thing that we want to focus on this episode. We'll probably be back with more stuff, I'm sure, probably after we go into the dappling and Brachiosaurus stuff that David wants to talk about. Great. All right, well, we'll be right back. Stick with us for Infinity Wars. Now we're starting to crack the microphones.
My ears.
So, here we are, a month after it came out, or however long.
2 weeks.
Is it 2 weeks?
It's only been 2 weeks, dude.
Mm, oh, wow. It feels like forever.
Yeah.
Infinity Wars, the latest Avengers film, which is funny because Black Panther was still in theaters when I saw it. And the Ant-Man, the Ant-Man trailer like came out like the next day.
Yep.
These things are getting faster and faster. Okay, so we all saw Infinity Wars.
Wait, you're supposed to see Infinity War?
Not just speculate about it? All right, what'd you guys think, Ben?
I think it's been the first Marvel movie that I saw in theaters that I've wanted to go back and see.
Mm.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun.
David?
It was fine. It was fine.
I think I liked it the most then out of you guys, because I did see it twice.
Mm. Ooh.
Yeah. And it was so nice to go see that film after that god-awful Ready Player One. I thought this movie was great. I liked it a lot. And we can go into why.
Yeah.
And hash it out.
Yeah.
So I David and I did talk about this a little bit, because we went to go see the movie together, and we got lunch, and we felt like, oh, well, we can't not talk about the movie already.
Yeah, it was going to be a week before we had the podcast, so we decided we had to talk it a little bit.
And the interesting thing that he said that I was not expecting was that David had cared about some of the characters or what happened to them.
But there's a problem. I cared, but I don't know why I cared or knew why I should care.
It's it's that thing you have in your chest that pumps blood.
Oh no, I got rid of that.
David, you are a human.
I traded that for my for my iMac.
Okay.
Looking at it, and I think when I was thinking about it more since we talked, I'm thinking part of it is time made me care. Like, these are now characters and storylines that have now been growing and evolving over the course of the last 10 years. And, you may be in a relationship with somebody you don't like that much, you've been in there for 10 years.
I think that's by design. I think I did that intentionally.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I do want to talk about later towards the end of this discussion, comparing this to how DC is handling theirs.
Yeah.
Because it's very different. But I was thinking back on it. I'm like, I think it's mainly because some of these characters have been around and been in these movies for 10 years now. So you would care a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do think that this whole MCU is interesting in the sense that each movie almost kind of is like an episode of a series.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like the MCU is like a TV series, and each episode is like a 2.5 hour long special on a specific character.
Yeah, or like you could say each one is like an issue of a comic, and then every so often, like I think the people who read the comics commonly say that every month is a new issue, and then every year at the same time there's like the
big arc.
Yeah, like there's like a big event. So this is feels like that, mm-hmm. which is really cool. Specifically, what characters did you care about, David?
Probably Iron Man for one, because I think of the MCU, I think Iron Man is my favorite character.
He's the best.
And the other one,
Mr. Thor over here. No, Captain America.
Captain America.
Yeah, yeah, you are.
We're in a civil war.
You know, I'm surprised because I gotta say right now, if he grew out his hair a little bit, he wouldn't look too far off from Chris Evans in this movie.
Oh man, inflate his ego.
Yeah, I'm surprised we haven't seen you do any cosplay. Anyway, wait, let me kind of get a guess. If you were to do it, I bet you're going to do the World War II costume. Am I right?
I mean, I have to slim down regardless. So
okay, but anyway, so you cared about Tony Stark.
Care about that one. And then the other one, and the reason I think I cared about this one is just from a human relatability level, and that is Scarlet Witch and Vision and their characters, because it's a morbid thing, but the thoughts have crossed my mind before. I am married, and so the thoughts have crossed my mind of like,
what if she had to kill me?
What if, or vice versa, what if I had to kill her or something, and how terrible and how gut-wrenching that would be if you face that knowing there is no other reasonable option. And it's a horrible thought to have. And so I think, that one I cared about.
So what didn't you like about this film? Let's dive deep. Let's go into it. Because it's easy to say I really like this movie and the end.
Well, let us begin.
Okay. So let it be for the record, David has 6 pages of notes.
Yeah. Real quick thing before you start, I just wanted to say, isn't it awesome how in every subsequent episode, Tony Stark has a more ridiculous way to get on his suit on?
Yeah, he does.
I thought with the first Avengers, I thought that was peak like craziness, because he's falling off the building and he's got his little wrist straps the suit rockets down and like attaches to the wrist and then like comes on his body mid and then attaches to his body mid air. I thought that was like, okay, we can't get any crazier. And now in this movie, he's got nanotech that can just like reassemble itself within seconds.
Yep.
Which is cool. I think that, like, because nanotech's a real thing. So I think it fits.
And that's universe. I have done research on it. Yeah. And that is an evolution of his armor in the comics. It's been done.
I again, love Spider-Man. I love the dynamic with Stark and Spider-Man. And it's cool that Spider-Man's suit, built by Tony Stark, has the cool spider claw things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? A lot of cool
stuff.
Got
the whole father-son dynamic.
Here we go. I'm sure we'll get more things into this.
Let's look at this thing.
All right, go ahead.
Stormbreaker.
Yes.
So I guess when Ben and I were watching this movie together, Ben freaked out and totally man-crushed over Peter Dinklage.
I was like, tapping.
It's him. Which was funny. But, okay.
Is that critique?
No, that's just a funny comment on Ben squealing.
That's the one thing I kind of... didn't like, but kind of gave me pause, because I thought that making him big just seemed strange. It didn't really look right. It looks like the big Muppet character, you know, the big hairy Muppet full-size guy.
Yep.
All right, go ahead.
So Stormbreaker. I know that in other research and whatnot I've done since, like, you know, it's another weapon. It's sort of the replacement hammer that Thor has used at times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so they restart the forge.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that whole bit, whatever.
Conveniently happens to have two little arm things to open it.
Right. That are perfectly spaced for a human, not for a dwarf, but a human.
Well, he had to reach. What if a dwarf could just go like, you know.
A dwarf could not fit in that circle.
Yeah,
whatever. Anyway, so the beam shoots and it melts down whatever those ingots are. And then pours into a mold.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have done research. If Stormbreaker had been forged, it would have been... It would have had 26% more tensile strength.
Oh, God.
And this is based on, obviously, human...
Is this your number one critique, by the way?
No.
We're diving into a deep cut. You should start from the top and go down.
And it had a 37% higher fatigue strength if it had been forged. And it was not forged. It was die-cast. So I say to you, Mr. Thor, no, his hands do matter, because he needed to forge that shit. It should not have been... It should not have been cast.
So you're saying that... Okay, forged much stronger than molded.
Yes, it did not make a lick of sense that it was molded. That was just
okay.
Sick.
Okay, okay. But so let's move on to some. But this is not earthling blacksmithing. This
it's very true.
This is some crazy cosmic.
However, yeah. It's still silly. Okay, that's
start with the most comprehensive.
Okay,
critique.
So one of the big critiques is the story itself.
Okay,
the pacing of the story.
Sure.
The I think the story was pretty much this pattern exactly the whole time for 2.5 hours or whatever it was. Action, exposition, action, exposition, action, exposition, action, exposition.
Sure.
And the exposition was exposition. It was not anything but exposition. I felt like the vast majority of the time when characters are talking, it is exposition dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
It is not doing other things to develop the characters or develop the story beyond necessary exposition.
Mm.
And that bothered me.
Okay.
I will slightly push back on that. But
I would also, but I would just say that with respect to the character development, the only character that needed development in this film was Thanos, and I think they did it quite convincingly.
I would agree.
Because every other character in the film has already been established and developed.
Mm-hmm.
This
to
is
my
very
satisfaction.
True. This is very true, and I think that's a reason why that is, for some people, perfectly fine,
mm-hmm.
that thing. Because, yes, these characters have been developing for a long time, and this is the culmination.
Right. Ben, so, what's your pushback?
Well, so I was gonna expand on that, in that I think that Marvel movies have gotten better because they've put more focus, or have taken focus from establishing the heroes and put more focus into establishing and humanizing villains.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, I can think of in Black Panther, they spent some time with Black Panther, but then they spent more time on Warmonger. And I think in some ways, these villains are more of failed heroes. They have like a thought process that like their insanity is relatable. It's like it's somewhat logical, but it's a fallacy.
I think, and I kind of love that idea for a villain being the fallen hero, like mm-hmm. like the person who, as Thanos said in the beginning of the film, like knew he was right and failed, and now he's on this path. Like, quick tangent, Warcraft 3 is one of my favorite anti-heroes, which is Arthas, because mm-hmm. you start off as the good guy and begin this slow descent into madness, and then you're mm-hmm. like one of the biggest villains in the game. All right, keep going, David.
Yeah. Cool. But I would, on that note, I would agree that Samuel L. Jackson, Thanos, had an uncentral motive, and I think the Avengers, did a great job of combating him.
Oh, you're making a Kingsman
joke. I'm making
reference.
A Kingsman
yeah.
joke.
What was his thing? He wanted to combat global warming by killing most people?
Yep, killing about a third of the Earth or two-thirds of the Earth. Yep.
I will say it's probably...
That's just a little joke. There's nothing.
I think it's you're right, maybe a little bit of a tired...
Your
motivation
arm is hitting the soundboard and it's creating a whole bunch of bumps.
Oh. Maybe it's a little bit of a tired, motivation, but it's probably better in my eyes than the I love death and want to kill everybody from the comics.
Yeah, totally.
But someone did find there was evidence of the comics that Thanos' motivation was to kill half the
universe. That whole thing is from the comic. That was a joke. Thing. Oh. I didn't mean anything by that one.
I would say I prefer it in this movie than in Kingsman.
Yeah.
Whereas Kingsman's just like, all right, here's like spun the wheel and landed on this.
The tones
for
of the
motivation.
Movie are different.
Mm-hmm. So here's a thing, and I've talked about this on about many, many movies before, and I think it comes from a lack of foresight and thinking things through, and that is that the Infinity Gauntlet is an incredibly, incredibly, incredibly OP MacGuffin. It is too powerful for its own good,
mm-hmm.
and... Essentially, they have created the perfect weapon or tool that in reality, if it were one of us using it, it would be an end game that there is no escape from.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, we look at we're probably gonna start talking about spoilers now. Heads up to everyone, spoilers. Vision is killed, and then Thanos turns back time.
Right.
That alone. Is a world-breaking power,
mm-hmm.
Which also is a question. Oh, why didn't Doctor Strange put Thanos in a time prison? Just saying.
Right. No. I had that same question, and I think that we just have to assume that he thought of that and that wasn't going to work.
Perhaps
because he looked ahead into the possible
yep.
futures.
And the same thing with the Reality Stone. Now the ability to bend and change reality is a world-breaking power.
Sure.
There is, again, like, so if that were me now, if I were Thanos and I escaped from there, well, I'm just going to make 100 million clones of myself scattered across the universe, and then I'm just going to retire safely hiding away, and no one would ever find me.
No.
It would be, you know, with these, with those kinds of tools, there is no reasonable way,
right,
to escape.
But on that quick note though, is it, I'm not totally clear on the properties of the of what the Reality Stone does, because it seems to change reality, but it seems to be an illusion, right? Because like when he turns I forget Muscle Guy from Guardians of the Galaxy into like Swiss cheese or whatever, and he just chops him up, he's still alive.
But we have seen evidence that it is not an illusion, because Peter Quill goes to shoot Gamora, and it is turned into a bubble gun.
Yeah, that's right.
And it,
okay.
And she and Gamora tries to stab herself, turns into bubbles, and it's not an illusion that it disappeared. So I think those are world breaking powers that have no reasonable way of being counteracted. On that note, there's a kind of thing where like at the end, I really didn't give a shit who died, because there's a gauntlet and a stone that can turn back time.
Yeah.
So it's like, not like I am sure there are some people that may die in the next film or may not come back, or vice versa. You know, I'm pretty sure there will be things, because there are actors there that we think are sort of feeling they're sort of done with the series. Like mainly among them, Robert Downey Jr.
Yep.
So there are. You know, there may be some other reasons, and I'm sure, I think there's, you know, that we're starting to get into like the new, like stage one of like the next generation of Marvel heroes, which I also want to talk about a little later.
But you're right. It feels like they can come back.
The stakes are somewhat hollow for me. So I know some people really cared, but I'm like, this can all be undone.
Yeah, no, it can, but. Even though it can be undone, and I think most people watching the film know that, you still feel a loss at the end, especially because that's where it ends.
Eh.
You don't?
Okay. I didn't really like, okay, yeah, people are dead and they'll be back. Or they can be back.
So on the point of the gauntlet, I'll push back on you a little bit, because I think that while it's... Well, I agree with you in the sense that it's OP, I think by nature it is and should be. Because when you look at all of the heroes in these Marvel films, a lot of them are kind of because they are outwilled, and because they outwill their villain, or they outstrength them. You know, like by means of something or rather, they forcibly win. With the exception of Doctor Strange, in his movie, I think. The gauntlet is supposed to be a way to take away those elements.
Yeah.
The Marvel, like the Marvel heroes, cannot punch their way through this. Like they're intended to lose.
Right.
Like Thanos, when they fight the same way, because Thanos has the will. They talk about Thanos's will multiple times in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to beat him that way. So I suspect in the next movie, assuming that they beat Thanos, which we could probably, you know, properly
safely assume.
They beat him by flaws within his character, not in brute strength.
Yep. This is true. And also, I think if you don't see after the actual snap at the end, you do not see very many shots of the gauntlet itself. But in the few shots you do, it does look damaged.
Yeah,
it looks like it may be broken. There may be stones that are broken.
And
now. So there may be another way out through
there. Thanos also has like damage on his neck and his arm. Like it did something to him physically.
And, he also had an axe to the chest.
Yeah.
And, which also, again, snap, fixed.
But I will say that it seems, though, that Thanos was trying to use the full might of the gauntlet to stop the axe, and it didn't work. So it seems like Thor still has something to use against him that can override the gauntlet's power, even though the gauntlet now looks like it can't function as it did before.
Yeah. I thought that was an interesting point, though, with the whole axe to the chest versus the head.
Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, it probably would have broken. It doesn't have the tensile strength to do.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was another like funny point that the reason why like Thor failed is because he chose a chest point instead of a head, alluding more to like Thor's failure is his ego. He wants to have those moments where he's like, I'm going to tell you, like, I'm going to start monologuing kind of deal. Yeah. And
he should have gone for the arm.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just cut off the arm.
There was another interesting point. I don't remember if I heard this on A Half in the Bag or if it was somewhere else, but another interesting thing that, you know, you look at the motivations between the Avengers, if you will, the human relatable characters and Thanos, they have it where the, and this is said in dialogue at some points, but you don't trade lives,
yep.
In it. And for almost every stone, I think pretty much every stone, the characters who are in a place of power over the stone, they have, know where it is or they have it. They are almost always, they also almost have a choice, mm-hmm. between giving up the stone or sacrificing someone else. And every single time they either hesitate for good reason, I'm not faulting them for hesitating, or they choose to spare the life,
right.
of another rather than give up, rather than withhold the stone.
I think the only person who tries to who doesn't end up sparing life is Scarlet Witch, but that's because Vision's like, no, you got to kill me.
Yep. Yeah, and that was, and obviously that choice was the last one.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That was like, you know, you saw the you know, you saw the king.
Yeah.
You saw the final checkmate move coming.
Yeah.
They had but one choice. You know, but yeah, I said the only other hesitation would be Quill hesitated in shooting Gamora.
Oh yeah.
Which, to be fair, even if he didn't hesitate, the result would have been probably the same. Is they,
and
it would have been a bubble gun.
On the note of Vision, so that was really interesting how he turned back time. I mean, I didn't see it coming, though I should have. But
yeah,
I am curious what the Wakandan scientist did moments before the minions of Thanos broke through, because she was doing something, that she was finishing up something.
Yep.
And I've seen theories that like she uploaded a Vision's consciousness somewhere, so he still exists in some capacity.
Yeah,
which would be interesting.
It would.
But okay, so what else we got on this chart here of critiques for this great movie?
Again, like I don't know if there would have been a happy way around it. To make me happy, it was a CGI fun fest with really the only real place being on when they're on Earth. Pretty much every other location there was pretty much an entirely CG environment.
The Titan was a set with set extensions.
Right. Yes, and also, I hate that name.
Titan?
Yes. Why? Because I am a science nerd.
Oh, and it's a moon?
And I know that it's a moon in our solar system, and that it's clearly not where that is.
Sure.
I would have arguably said they should have changed the name.
Although, it's tough, though, because if they're taken from the comics, like...
Yes, but like they say Titan, I'm like, oh, they're not going that far away. They're only going to Saturn. What's the big deal, guys? or not Saturn.
Isn't it Jupiter?
Jupiter, yep.
Yeah, with you going there in Destiny 2.
Yeah, yeah,
huge,
right.
Tidal waves.
So that was...
Sure.
I
think... all right, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, the other thing is, so Thor... So one, like they, one thing that I think they did really, really well, and that really surprised me of how well they did it, was managing a ridiculously large ensemble cast.
Sure.
Yeah, they did really, really well in doing that, and the main reason it did so well is, for the most part, they never have all of them in the same place at once. They've split into crews.
Yeah, which I think
here,
from the reviews that I've seen, all agree. Yeah, that was the right way to do it.
It was
effectively
the only way. So we had the Titan crew, which was basically the handful of the Guardians that are about half the Guardian team, and Doctor Strange, Iron Man, and Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Stormbreaker crew, which was Groot, Rocket, and Thor. And you had the Wakanda crew, which was pretty much everyone else. And then you had the cutaways to Thanos and the Thanos crew. This was an excellent choice in making.
Well,
it
and you had teams combined in interesting ways. So, you had the Guardians of the Galaxy crew combined with the Strange and Stark crew.
Yeah, they did a great job of pairing people off into interesting combinations. I thought, like, you know, the whole bit with Groot, Rocket, and Thor was very entertaining.
Yeah.
And which I think is interesting because, like, the last Thor movie was definitely done more with a tonal shift towards Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes.
So it's interesting that they kind of, like, maybe it's like a primer. Like, they prime Thor to fit into...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah. That's a very good point.
I love the moment he's like, this is my friend Tree. I am Groot. I am Steve Rogers.
Oh, we're using our made-up names? I'm Spider.
Because it's funny, because Doctor Strange is a weird name.
Yep.
But I loved watching, my favorite part of the movie is probably watching Iron Man, Doctor Strange fight Thanos on Titan.
Yeah.
And then he just grabs the moon and pulls it in. It's like, that's so cool.
It was fun. One thing, though, that I did not care for in that moment is, so we have Thor has gotten Stormbreaker, and then he is our Deus Ex Machina, no pun intended.
Well, not necessarily, because that's implying that it came out of nowhere. This was... this had a trajectory towards Thanos. Like
not to Thanos though, but to the Wakandan fight. And he lands and he hits like three people and then it cuts away. I thought that they should have lingered on that new ass kickery for a little bit longer. I felt like it had a bit of a lesser impact because it's cut away so quickly. A
little nitpicky.
I mentioned this to Ben. Scarlet Witch's accent is like completely gone now. It went from thick Russian or thick Eastern Bloc accent, and to like, but now it's nothing at all.
So real quick on the subject of the X-Men in this film, the enhanced. So you bring up how the gauntlet is game breaking or story breaking or universe breaking. I think that it can be in concept, but on paper, but they did a really good job of making it not necessarily feel that overpowerful because the heroes are so powerful to counteract him. Like Doctor Strange is like this like god character. For example, in Age of Ultron, you could, you know, going into that movie, a lot of people, including myself, had just seen Days of Future Past. And wow, Quicksilver is this like game-breaking X-Men who can basically be God. Whereas the Quicksilver in Age of Ultron, yeah, he can run really fast, but he can still get hit by bullets. Like, he's not just an invincible dude. So when the Avengers were moments away from having the glove off Thanos, it was just like, oh yeah, no, he can be taken out. I mean, it's not like this like invincible dude. Like these guys can come together.
He can bleed a drop of blood.
Yeah, so I think they did a really good job of keeping the tension up of he can be defeated if everyone operates in, you know, in concert with each other. That was just me though.
David, you mentioned managing the crossovers really well, and I think to expand, I would say that they did a very good job at keeping true to each character. That each character didn't like have to become more serious or more funny, or like I think that each character still stayed very much themselves. And I liked that.
Yeah, definitely. It was really fun watching Tony Stark interact with Doctor Strange, because seeing the Doctor Strange film, it's like, wow, he's a lot like Tony Stark. I wonder how they're going to interact with each other. And yeah, I think that their personalities, the differences really came out.
Yes.
In this one.
I think so.
I especially like how Doctor Strange, I rewatched that one again recently, how he changed from the arrogant, you know, asshole doctor to like this really sincere, you know, mystical dude who believes in his mission to his core, which is really cool.
Do you have a favorite moment in the movie?
Probably when Thanos grabs the moon. And Iron Man's fight. Iron Man and Doctor Strange fighting Thanos on Titan is probably my favorite part, because it was just how badass those two guys are fighting Thanos. I thought that was so awesome. And then Tony Stark is like, if you throw another moon at me, I'm really going to lose it.
The one moon, that was okay. Yeah. I can deal with it, but Ben? A second moon, no go.
I think my favorite moment was probably when Stark and Thanos were fighting one-on-one. That specific fight I thought was really cool, because you saw a lot of like desperation from Iron Man like pulling out all the stops, and Thanos keeps winning, and then like the whole like I hope they remember you thing. I thought that was a really like big hard hitting moment. I mean, I love Captain America, but I feel like he didn't really show up in this movie much at all.
Yeah, not so much.
Go ahead. Or what about the other heroes that decided to call in sick?
Like Ant-Man?
Ant-Man, which was in dialogue. And Hawkeye?
Hawkeye. I was like,
all right, where the hell is Hawkeye?
Next movie.
Yeah.
If at all, who knows?
Yeah. But I agree. Captain America, with the exception of him trying to grab the gauntlet, I felt a little underpowered in this one, which was okay for me, because it seems like in every movie he's more and more powerful.
No, I was going to say, I think that like that was not showing him underpowered. That was showing how powerful he is.
Oh, no, I know. I think it was, my point is that it's ridiculous he even tried to grab the gauntlet.
Yeah. But he seemed to be holding his own at least for a little bit on it.
I will say that when you were talking about like nerd stuff, David, about like Titan and whatnot, there was one thing that bothered me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when Spider-Man references the plan to get rid of the sorcerer dude, he says, have you guys seen the movie Aliens?
Yeah.
But the way that they get rid of the alien...
Are you sure it was Alien? Or
he says,
Aliens?
He says Aliens with an S.
Yes.
But the way they defeat the alien in Alien is by doing what they did.
Yeah.
Nope, it's in both.
It's in both.
In okay, Aliens, it is also, the queen is also blown out an airlock.
Okay.
In space.
There we go.
Thank you. Thank you, what's his face, for another rinse and repeat. Cameron. James Cameron.
Yes. I did appreciate that in a lot of well, not, it's happened twice now. I appreciate that Spider-Man's just like, hey, have you ever seen that old movie? Just like, yeah, from my childhood. Was it? Well, I guess we weren't alive, but
we would have. Yeah, we grew up in a, that, in a different way.
That
than
old movie, Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
But I guess yeah, I don't know. Everything just really came together really well for this movie. I wasn't bothered.
It's a long movie.
I wasn't bothered by this.
It didn't feel long to me, though, which I thought was surprising, because I thought I would feel a fatigue by the end of it, but they did. Mm-mm. They were ramping the tension in an effective way.
I was like, when credits rolled, I was like, no, you still got to do stuff.
Yep. But did you notice that there was the ending? There's usually at the end of these big tent poles, it says the Avengers will return.
Thanos will return.
And it just, that's all it said.
What did you guys think of the cliffhanger at post credit scene?
I thought,
okay, that pagers.
It makes sense in universe, though.
It does, because the Captain Marvel movie, it takes place in the 1990s.
Right.
Which, on that note, I feel like the Ant-Man and the Wasp movie shouldn't be coming out right now. Or in between.
Even if it takes place before Infinity Wars?
Yes. Because I think it may dissolve some of the tension. I think that if they were going to do any movies between this one and then Avengers 4, it should have been just Captain Marvel. And they are going to do that one because they do need to introduce that character. Is that who the escape? That's who the message went out to. That's her logo, which I got to say, what a dumbass pager. If we can't say Captain Marvel on the screen, but we can put her logo up for sure.
It's for hype. Come on.
I know. Yeah. So I don't think they should be doing Ant-Man and the Wasp between them. I think because arguably it will either happen where that movie, by the looks of it, will either the ending of Ant-Man and the Wasp will be corresponding with the end of Avengers,
otherwise known as the Snapshire.
Awesome!
Oh, I get it.
Awesome! Awesome! Or it will happen well enough before that the events don't overlap at all, which I think kind of dissolves some tension because they have a.
I guess we'll see. I could go either way.
Ben,
did you like the post cred?
I felt indifferent about it, to be honest. I mean, it's cool that they're hyping up Captain Marvel, and I'm like, honestly, I'm looking forward to that.
Which is basically the MCU's version of Superman, right?
I don't. I guess maybe I don't know enough. I don't think that's quite right, but
she/he, depending on what era you're in and which series, they are a very powerful. They do have a lot of powers.
But they're basically their role is to replace Captain America as the leader of the Avengers, aren't they?
I don't know. No. I don't know anything about that.
Where are my MCU?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So okay. So to wrap up here, what's you know, another juicy criticism here?
So I have two things. Do we want to go into wrap up?
Well,
on this.
We're at an hour now, so okay, we should probably get there.
So here I have two wrap-up points that I want to talk about. And one of them is, this may be stating the obvious, but I wanted to take even a brief moment to look at how Marvel has handled these culminating movies, starting with the first Avengers film, which was 4 years ago now?
It was 2012, I think.
5 years ago.
Six.
whatever. I can't do math. I don't know what year it is. Versus DC. Mm-hmm. Because by comparison, DC, I don't think anyone would argue, is doing a terrible job.
Yeah, and it seems very reactionary. Yes. Like they go in a direction and then they just course correct like you wouldn't believe based on fan reaction, much like Microsoft does with the Xbox, getting rid of Kinect and all that stuff. So it's like, oh, it's too dark and gritty, so they make it kind of light and funny, but then that doesn't really work at all because people...
Your expectations were already set.
Yeah, and it's like, I heard that the best parts of... I didn't watch the Justice League movie, but I heard the best parts were the dark and gritty parts, which they wanted to, you know, cut in favor of a more Josh Whedon feel. So you've got, like, was it a post-credit scene with Superman and Flash trying to race each other?
Sure.
It's just like,
I don't know.
It just seems so reactionary.
I started watching it on an airplane. I think I made this observation on the podcast, but I'd come to the conclusion that your time on the airplane, your time is worth the least on an airplane because you're a captive audience to nothing. You know, with rare exception, I've done work on an airplane and been productive, but in the greater scheme of things, your time is worth the least on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the joke that like I started watching Ghostbusters and said, nope, my time is still worth more than that.
The reboot, right?
Yes, the reboot. Yeah, yeah. And same thing happened with Justice League. I started watching it, got about 20 minutes in and said, nope, my time is worth more than this.
I'd rather stare into the blackness of like
a turned off screen.
Yeah, exactly.
Than this.
Well, I think the issue with the DC universe is that they're good just going like,
they're going all in deep into it. Yep, they're trying
to establish any of the characters before.
Yep, and as I said, like that was an effective way to, whether I wanted to or not, to care about the characters. Yeah. Is I've been now watching them change and develop over the course of 10 years, mm-hmm. and not just like Superman movie, Batman movie, everybody.
Yeah, it's just like, God, Wonder Woman's probably the best reviewed one so far from that universe.
It is.
And just like, why not just whoever did that, just keep going with that style, because. Mm-hmm. Man, that's just a sinking ship at this point. Maybe they make their money back. I don't know, but God, there's just no comparison.
Well, I think that's the problem, is that they're trying to compare themselves to the MCU.
Oh, absolutely.
Whereas like DC should just like try to be their own thing.
Bring
like,
in Christopher Nolan to do the rest of it. Seriously, I mean, the best Batman films, in my opinion, are his. Mm-hmm. Oh, Tim Burton, I guess. But
oh no, I think they balanced the real world and the comic book world.
Yeah.
Perfectly in the Nolan films. Like, it is a beautiful balance of a realistic vigilante superhero.
Yeah, with the exception, I felt kind of awkward when they kept trying to switch between Chicago and New York as far as like where it was set.
Yeah.
That just didn't seem right to me.
And Philadelphia, which is where they shot all of the third one.
Oh.
All shot in Philadelphia. They it was like all shot in Chicago for Batman Begins, about 75% shot in Chicago for
Dark Knight
and was that about 25% Philadelphia, and then for the third one it was like all shot in Philadelphia. I
mean, Chicago is Gotham.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah, because Metropolis is supposed to be New York and
Chicago. Yep.
Anyway, but going back to Avengers quick, I remembered one point that I had. I do miss that when Tony Stark used to wear an actual Iron Man suit and not a CG suit.
Mm. Yep.
I rewatched scenes from Iron Man 2 where he's actually physically wearing the suit.
Well, he's mostly wearing a suit.
Yeah, it was the scene where he's in the diner talking to Fury. And mm-hmm. I'm like, that just seems just cooler to me because it feels like a bulky suit of armor as opposed to now where it's like this fluid, I don't know, Superman suit.
I noticed some connections between with Bungie and Halo. Started armor starting out as a very realistic, bulky thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then 343 got involved and it all went for smooth.
Yeah. It's been interesting with the Avengers movies, how they've the way that they present the movie has changed. Like the first Avengers was really kind of from Captain America's perspective, and then Avengers 2 is kind of Tony Stark and Captain America, and then this one is kind of like everybody. I don't know whose perspective it really is.
I think this one is still strongly Iron Man.
Yes,
because there are many things that do seem to put Iron Man at the epicenter of things.
Absolutely.
And so on that note, the last thing I wanted to touch on that was a thought that it was crossing my mind, and to use a term that they use in the movie, is this movie the start of the end game for Marvel as a whole?
I guess we'll see, because, I mean, ideally they'd want to just keep this gravy train rolling, huh?
Absolutely, but when we look at it, As I mentioned earlier, there are some stars that I think are interested in tapping out.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Chris Evans, look at Iron Man.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think what they'll do is they'll phase out the original Avengers and get the next group to come up.
Yes. And so, but my question will be, is will people care as much? Because as soon as you migrate away from this group, you are now getting into more lesser known superheroes. Like, if before all this had come out, if you had said, do you know who Captain America is? I would say yes. I had never read a comic, but yes, I know who Captain America is. I have a rough idea, very loosely, but I could identify. I could point him out in a lineup.
Yeah.
Now when you're getting beyond this, now I have, like, I don't know, like, you know, I had never heard of Captain Marvel before they announced that there was going to be one, in, like, you know, 5 years ago when they said it was in the pipeline.
I mean, I take your point, but I didn't know who Thanos was, but now I care about Thanos, so I guess we'll see.
I wonder if they just take a break, like step back a little bit and maybe just start kind of, I mean, maybe from a money perspective that you don't, but like Star Wars has done that. Star Wars did a break and came back and it was popular for better or for worse. And then Star Wars went on another break and then came back.
Yeah.
And it's been popular again.
But I mean, that was a different, cause that was changing hands and like,
and that was also a thing. I feel like that was not a self-imposed stepping back.
Hmm.
I think there were probably other factors in there. And I think the idea of if you were to go to Marvel and say, hey, you have a movie that's now number one in the box office for, you know, it's the third week in the row coming on or whatever, the biggest opening weekend of all time, you got two more movies and then you need to stop. 2 years. and not make a single movie.
Yeah. I mean, they'll
say, get the fuck out of here.
I get the impression that to get to that point, they'll probably have to do something similar to Assassin's Creed, where they get to a point where their products they're putting out, in this case, it'd be movies, is just lower and lower received. And then they'll be like, all right, we need to take a step back and kind of mm-hmm. figure out what we're doing.
See, here. I wish the companies would be more willing to take that choice before you start to see a decrease.
I think they just don't from a financial perspective. Like, hey, they're still making money. Let's keep making
them. I understand, but I wish people would do it. Like, you know, I look at Doctor Who, Doctor Who is technically the longest running TV series of all time. You know, it's been running technically since the 40s. But the thing is, it's not been running constantly since then. It runs for a while and they say, okay, we're out for 7 years.
And then
they step away.
Do they reboot with a new character then?
Yes or no, it's still Doctor Who, but there's an in-universe thing that they explain
right,
about
but,
that.
And I think that's actually genius. But
it is.
But like, if you take that in-universe explanation out, is it still a reboot with a new character?
Is it still a reboot with a new...
Because they get a new doctor to play, right?
Yes.
And is it like the arc still continues, or is it just like, all right, and
I think
we're back?
For some of them, yes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the arc continues. It depends on where that regeneration lands.
Sure.
If it's landing in the middle of a series, yes, the arc continues as normal. Mm-hmm. But if it's like we've been off the air for 7 years or 10 years or whatever, then usually we'll start with a new...
Yeah, set. No, I think that's great, because that way you get the best of all the worlds. You get the energy of a reboot with the in-universe explanation of a continued story.
Yes.
I think that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, anyway. To wrap up, do you guys recommend Infinity Wars?
Yeah, go see it.
I say...
Go, let's see if we can knock Avatar off the top notch at this point. I think at this point we should just go for that.
I mean, if you've seen the other Marvel movies and you're kind of like, I'll watch Marvel movies, go see Infinity War, because it really kind of changes a lot of the landscape. Mm-hmm. So if you care about any of the other kind of following movies, it's worth watching Infinity War. And it's probably like the best Marvel movie that's come out so far.
Yeah. I think obviously definitely see it, especially if you've seen the Marvel films. If you haven't seen any of them, probably not going to make any sense.
And actually, I was going to say, interestingly, if you haven't seen any of the other ones, it probably doesn't stand very well.
No, probably not.
Because characters don't really change and develop, as we talked about, because that all happened in the other movies.
That's the one caveat I would make. But anyway, other than that, thank you so much for listening to the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. Make sure to check out the video on creating virtual cameras from plates and all that goodness we're going to put on YouTube. Links will be somewhere, hopefully, in the description if we'll figure that out.
Yum.
All right, great. See you guys next time for episode 22.
Gomorrah was totally...